Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Coach Conversations. My name is Catherine Halpin. It's my extreme pleasure to host our Blog Talk Radio show. Coach Conversations is sponsored by the Phoenix chapter of the International Coach Federation. It's produced by Anna Malikian, PhD, ACC, and a Book Yourself Solid Elite Certified Coach. And it's hosted by me, Catherine Halpin, MCC. You can visit our show page at blogtalkradio.com/ICF Phoenix. There you can find links to our websites. If you're listening to this show live and have a computer nearby, please visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/ICF Phoenix. You'll find a post on this show, and we're going to use that post as our virtual chat room during the next hour. If you have comments, questions, or insights, please write them there. Even if you're listening to the recording of the show, visit our page at facebook.com/ICF Phoenix. We would love to hear from you. We have some very important information if you are a certified coach, certified by the International Coach Federation. You can get free CCEUs for ICF-accredited coaches when you listen to our Coach Conversations. And in May of 2014, we will celebrate 3 years, which means you'll have 36 months or 36 hours of free CCEUs that you can gain. All of our previous shows all qualify with the ICF, and these particular credits may be used for your individual credential renewal for the non-core competency CCEUs that you need. Visit ICFPhoenix.com for more details about that. And today our special guest is Diane Brennan from Tucson, Arizona, and we're going to speak to Diane about coaching professionalism, owning our roots, and strengthening the field. Diane Brennan, MBA, MCC, works with leaders and teams to expand thinking, navigate change, and create a learning culture. Her clients are in aerospace, academics, healthcare, science, and engineering. She is dean of the Master Coach Program for the Business Coaching Institute in Helsinki, Finland. She served as the first director of training for Fielding Graduate University's evidence-based coaching program. Diane is co-editor of the Handbook of Knowledge-Based Coaching with Lenny Wildflower, Ph.D., published in 2011, and The Philosophy and Practice of Coaching, published in 2008. Diane is recognized internationally as a leader in coaching and served as the Global International Coach Federation President in 2008. She is also a member of the European Mentoring and Coaching Council, a founding fellow of the Harvard Institute of Professional Coaching, and the International Positive Psychology Association. Diane, as I mentioned, lives in Tucson, Arizona. She can be reached at diane@coachdiane.com. So please join me in welcoming Diane Brennan. We're so pleased. Welcome, Diane. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Catherine. It's my pleasure to be here with you. I'm excited to be part of this show.
Yes, it's great fun. As I mentioned, in May we'll celebrate our third anniversary, which is unbelievable. And thanks to our producer, Anna Malikian, we've been quite successful. Sometimes we have as many as 4,000 listeners offline. And, you know, they download the show from Blog Talk Radio. And we're just thrilled with our following. And we're thrilled that we can give people continuing education credits. The purpose of our show is to promote the profession of coaching. We here in Phoenix, we have about, I don't know, at least 1,000, maybe 1,500 people that call themselves coaches. And we only have about 250 active members of our ICF Phoenix chapter. So there's a huge number of people out there that are not coach trained, but they're all good people. But we're just trying to promote, encourage that people get professionally trained and get certified and be professional in our profession. And I'm thrilled that you're going to share your perspective on all of that with us today. So if it's okay, I'd just like to get started with some very basic information. I always like to know where people grew up. So Diane, tell us where you grew up, and I'm going to be interested to know about your early family of origin.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a small coal region town in north central Pennsylvania, a little town called Cultmont. I don't think there were even 3,000 people there, but it was a wonderful place to grow up. Actually, even there today, when we go back home, because my husband's from the neighboring town, we hear of coaching. So even in that small town in Pennsylvania and that area, wow. I think coaching has made its way into even the smallest places, which is really incredible.
I love that. So that was, did you say coal mining? That's coal mining.
Coal mining, yes. Coal mining town. Uh-huh. Coal mining wasn't active by the time I was growing up, but still had major roots in that community. So very hardworking people, and remnants of the coal mines, actually. We had coal mining tours and coal banks of all the ashes, which now have trees on them. So it's pretty amazing how it's changed and what's
wonderful.
Happened. But yeah.
How that's evolved, yes. And did you grow up in a big family, or were you an only child? Tell us about
that. No, I have two sisters. I'm the oldest of two sisters, or three children. And my parents are first-generation Americans. My father, his family came from Italy, and my mother's from Russia, actually.
Oh.
And so, interesting. Our interesting cultural diversity among some of the relatives. I remember when I was a child, and of course now, because our ethnic origins were lots of that community had a lot of Polish, Italian, Russian, Ukrainian, German, so quite a mix of people immigrating to the U.S. at that time.
I bet that gave you tremendous exposure at an early age to just an extraordinary array of different experiences.
Yes, it did. It was, I say, though, it was kind of a sheltered environment compared to when we moved out to Arizona, very different type of environment, but it was a wonderful place as well. And even in my career as I started to look at what was next for me after graduating high school, actually, I stayed pretty close to home in where I went to school and with what I did. So it was a major move to come out to Arizona.
So when did you arrive in Arizona?
Came to Arizona in 1991, actually.
Okay.
Prior to coaching, I started my career as a nurse. I was a registered nurse initially, and then moved into management, nursing management, and got my MBA, was a hospital administrator, and then in physician practice, and came out to Arizona when one of my mentors was the chief operating officer at the hospital that I worked at, and he came out here to be the chief executive at a large medical group and called me and said, I have a great job for you, and you're going to love the weather.
Yeah,
and so we came out to Arizona, and we did fall in love with Tucson and Arizona. And when we came, it was July 4th weekend, so we really fell in love with even the crazy weather.
So great. Well, Tucson's such a beautiful city, so beautiful. Now, what were those pivotal experiences that led you out of leadership in healthcare into coaching?
I would say, looking back and knowing what I know about coaching now, I had a coach approach as a manager, as a leader. That's my style. I didn't know that, but that's the approach. When I first started coach training, I remember thinking, well, coaching is really good management because just what I was learning and listening and giving feedback and everything. And I'd say that some of the pivotal moments for me, this was before I knew what coaching was. In 1998, the medical group that I was part of, I was the executive director for, actually was bankrupted by its parent company. And I had every physician and non-physician provider in my office and looking at either individually or in groups, okay, we have 3 months. What are you going to do with the rest of your life? So I didn't know that was going to happen. But I look back and think, well, in a sense, you know, it was definitely there was a compelling reason to look at what was next for them, and that was really the approach that I used. And then years later realized, oh, I say that's my precursor to coaching. But after that, I was working with a medical group and had gone on travel, and when I came home, my husband had an article for me that had been in our newspaper, and it said coaching, the alternative to consulting. And so that was 1999, and I thought, this is interesting. You actually could do this work for a living and get paid for it, because it really did resonate. Yeah.
Yes, of course, with your style.
So I explored. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what were the next steps after you saw you learned that there was actually a profession called coaching?
Yeah, well, I started to explore it and looked at coach training, and I was I continued to be in my job, but I enrolled in coach training in 2000, January of 2000, with Coach U at the time, and so completed that program, but in that, so it took the 2 years to complete the full program because I was working full-time. And I stayed in my job in 2000, but realized midway through the year I was actually having clients and needed to make a decision. Was I going to continue to be in healthcare, or was I going to move into coaching? And so I talked with my physician group at the time and told them what I was doing. And at first they didn't believe me, but then later on they did. And actually they became a client of mine. And so it was a really nice transition as I completed 2000 and went into 2001. I was in my own business.
Oh, congratulations. That's so great that you were able to take, I always recommend people take their current employer, and whether they're going to be a coach or consultant or a trainer or whatever, speaker, those are the people that know you and respect
nice
you and trust you.
Yes.
It's a very nice way to land on your feet.
You're not struggling.
Yes. Now, I imagine that you got further coach training after your coaching experience. Tell us about that.
I got involved with ICF actually early on in 2000, right after I started the coach training actually, and because I had been involved in healthcare in my professional organization, so I was looking for where was the professional organization for coaching, and I found ICF, and so I went to the Vancouver conference that year. And I think you were on the board then.
Yes, I
remember. I remember seeing you. Yeah. Yes. And so over the years, kind of always kept up my education, even while I was with in training with Coach U, did some other things. But then in 2005, I was at an ICF conference in Norway and met Lenny Wildflower, who was at the time starting this Fieldings evidence-based coaching course. And I took that course. At that time, it was just the online portion. But it was a unique course in that it was pulling together theory that she saw that influenced coaching and talking about how does this work in practice. And so that really, for me, was a piece of what I felt like I was missing. Because while I'm not a theoretical person, I'm much more in the practice part of things. Everything that I learned in coaching or as I was developing, I think I've learned this before or I've seen this before. So whether it was psychology or adult development or change management, I thought there's tools here and there's theories or practices that can really underpin what we do in coaching. And so I started to, Lenny asked me if I'd work with her on the year-long program, and that's how I got involved with that and helped her develop
Very
the curriculum.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's extraordinary. So say more about that. I guess you would call those disciplines and theories our roots, our coaching roots, is that correct?
It is, yes, yes. It's our roots. And I'd say when I first started the coach training in 2000, I would say that in classes or with colleagues that were going through the program, I'd say, you know, I think this goes back to what I learned in psychology way back when I was in nursing or even in my graduate degree with some of the coursework there. And people would say, no, don't mention psychology. So we were a little afraid of it, I think, at the time for various reasons. And one I'd say was because we were really still developing what is coaching and really trying to understand and differentiate it from some of the other disciplines, particularly psychology. But now we've grown up or at least are growing and learning and taken more seriously. And I think that's in big part due to there's much, you know, not only the theories and the practices and research that come from other disciplines that ground coaching, but in coaching research itself with the evolution of coach training and the university programs that now are involved, we're seeing, I think, a lot more independent research that is specifically related to coaching and what we do that now is also, again, saying why what we do is important and why it works.
Mm-hmm. Yes, why what we do is important and even more importantly, why it works. So say more about your role in that research arena and where do we stand today?
So I consider myself a scholar practitioner, and I think that's what we all, I'd encourage coaches to be. Again, I came from a much more practical approach in everything that I've done, whether it was in healthcare or in coaching. I generally would have the job before I had the other training, so it's learning along the way. And so whether it was getting my bachelor's or my master's, that's how it all happened for me. But then in coaching as well, I'd say what we want to do now is to own those roots, to know that, or to become reflective practitioners if we're not already there, to be able to look at and this is good for two reasons. One is the building our skills and competencies, being able to look at what works, what doesn't work, what might I do differently next time from that place of learner rather than judge. And then from the theoretical understanding, so what did I do and why did that work? Or where did I draw that from? Being able to think through that. And even, whether it's writing brief case studies or articles or just posing questions on what you're noticing or observing even in online communities to be able to think through or notice what's happening in those coaching conversations. I think that's an approach that none of us should be afraid of. And that is, in a sense, doing our own research. And that's where that scholar practitioner comes in. So, and that's what moves the profession forward.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And I think anybody that's drawn to coaching is already a person who's, committed to continuous improvement and being a lifelong learner. And people like me that were already journalers for 30 years before I found coaching. So I think that most of us are doing that reflection, that thoughtful reflection. But I think so few of us are doing it with any discipline or structure or in alignment with any kind of thing that could be used, in an academic setting to say, to really sort of, say that this is part of the evidence of why coaching works. So for those of us lay people that don't consider ourselves scholars but yet are highly reflective, what recommendations would you have, Diane, that how could we add to that body of knowledge?
Well, I'd say think about coaching clients and what you've learned and what you might share. And so, again, it could be a brief article or it might be a case study. The first thing that I wrote actually was a case study. And I hadn't planned to do that, but I happened to meet an individual who was who I helped with something, who then sent me a note saying, "Hey, I'm in the process of writing a book on coaching. Would you be interested in writing a chapter?" And I thought, "Oh, me? Write that? What? I don't know if I can do that." And then thought, "Wait a minute, why not? And I'm sure people will help me if I need assistance." So I did that. And then in that same process of working through some things, all of a sudden I became co-editor with the individual. This was the first book that I participated in, the philosophy and practice of coaching. And what I wrote, my chapter in that, was a case study that I'm really proud of. And feel like it was simple, straightforward. It wasn't, it did not involve significant academic research, so we shouldn't worry about that. But I was, in the process of doing that work, I learned how to, to look up, where did I get this from? What was it that happened for me that, did it happen because I did something in particular that that I just thought of, or was there something that really grounded this and that I drew on that I didn't realize I was doing at the time? So being curious for ourselves, and then seeing what we get, what we can contribute in a way that's in alignment with who we are. And so it might also be contributing at ICF events on a local level. It might be thinking about being a speaker being part of different conferences. I think there's lots of ways. Or again, the online community is growing, and there's so many ways to participate in that. And those are great learning communities as well.
Mm-hmm. I love this. Thank you so much for encouraging all of us to participate. Now, one of the questions that I've always had in my 19 years of coaching is in our code of ethics, we have that confidentiality thing. So how do you,
yes,
when you wrote that first case study, how did you manage that? Did you keep the client confidential?
I talked with my client. I did keep the client confidential, but I also talked with the client about what I wanted to do and asked for permission to be able to use what we did in coaching as part of the case study. And then I had the client read it as well to make sure that I reflected accurately what I thought was happening, that it was actually, it was a really great review, because we both learned in the process. I've done others since then, like that, little case studies for different presentations or like smaller publications, and always involve the client. And then I know when people want to, there have been people that have used their actual clients and the client names with permission. In this case, I didn't want to do that, and it wasn't appropriate for the kind of book that it was either. So we kept the client confidential. The other way that I've seen people do it is actually switch the gender sometimes. Again, if it's a something that people might be able to figure out for whatever reason, because of the way the description of the company is. So you really want to anonymize the client, but to include the client
right,
in the process. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the key. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say and that whole review with the client, again, is a really nice way to both learn. And so what I've done since then is sometimes I will make notes afterwards if I'm having a coaching session of something that comes to mind that I might want to just see what happens with it, and then reflect on it with the client later if it's appropriate, which again is a great learning for both, to be able to ask the client their perspective on it, and as a coach. And it's again another way to look at what are we doing, and why is what we're doing working or not working.
Mm-hmm. And what can be improved.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, it makes me want to bring up thousands of coach situations that I've reflected on, and I'm still in the curiosity mode. But what I think what might be a better use of our time is to get you to share, Diane, some of your successes that you're most proud of, either around your documenting the successes or the coaching successes themselves, whatever would be most
sure. One of them, Yeah, one of them that stands out for me is one that I wrote a case study on. It was called Leadership Coaching and the Impact on the Organization. And this work was with a CEO of a hospital, and I was the coach going into the organization with two consultants, and this organization had consultants in there before, and the most recent ones said, CEO, you need a coach. So they threw their hands up in the air, and I thought, oh, this will be interesting. But we went into the organization. There was a lot of other work that occurred. The CEO was a fantastic individual, very successful, but really came to the organization during a time when it was a turnaround, and he turned them around, and they were making money. They were no longer losing money, but never changed his leadership style. And certainly that wasn't what I went in there with, knowing or thinking, but that's what emerged over time. And though he was kind of the type of client that I really love. He was interested, he was curious, and he was skeptical. And so with that skeptical nature, we sat down and just tried it. Know, just actually, rather than explain coaching, and he was interested enough to listen, but rather than sit there and try and define what it was that we were going to do, we actually engaged in coaching. And that engagement has been a model for me over the years, because it involved both in-person time and it was also by phone. And what I've learned over the years is if I'm working with a larger organization and I'm working with the chief executive, it's definitely worth spending some time there, because you learn a lot about the organization and you learn a lot about the individual. And every time I would be on site, something would happen, something interesting would happen. And one time was one of his meetings where he is very charismatic, had about 20 people in the room around a table, and he was talking and all of a sudden sat down, and when he sat down, he picked up a pen and he wrote something. And when he wrote something, everybody else wrote something, and I thought, wow, that's interesting. And we went to a break, and I asked him, what did he write? And he didn't want to tell me. And I explained, if he didn't tell me, I guaranteed he would have the reaction that they typically were saying was happening, was everything is about John, and they'd bring him something, and he'd say, what did you do this for? And they'd say, there he goes again. So he finally told me what he wrote down was, pick up bread and milk on the way home.
Oh.
And I said, yeah, I went, oh, fantastic, we have to tell them. And he looked at me like, you are out of your mind. But he knew me, and he trusted me, and he realized, yes, we have to tell them. So when we came back from the break, yeah, we told them. And it was, the single defining moment for that whole engagement. There were certainly lots of other things, but at that moment in time, he realized how much of an impact he had on everyone. And he really hadn't known that before, even though he knew he was the CEO. He did not expect them to pay such attention to him that they would not question something. And for them to realize that he was human, and he didn't always talk to them about something, or just because he said something didn't mean he was talking to them, because he clearly wasn't asking anybody to do anything. He was just going to pick up bread and milk on the way home.
I love that. It reminds me of a quote I saw probably 30 years ago. Some CEO said it, that, you know, if he sneezed, then his vice presidents, you know, got a cold, and if the vice presidents got a cold, then the middle managers got the flu,
right.
And then if they got the flu, then somebody on the front line was going to die.
people just make it up, that story.
Yeah. If they don't know the facts, if he doesn't come clean and say what he's doing, then they just make up all those stories.
Mm-hmm,
that's a great success. Oh, wow. Well, when you think of us as practitioners, either scholar practitioners or just practitioners, what do you think that we really need to know?
So I do think we need to know some of the foundations of our of this emerging profession. You know, I'd say So making sure, as you said at the beginning of the program here too, people who are calling themselves coaches really need to make sure they have some coach training. That it's certainly, they, if they're using a coach approach in their work as consultants, that's fantastic. And it's still relevant for them to get some coach training to be able to make sure they're grounded. So it's learning the skills and the competencies. And then also, I'd say coaching programs more and more now are including a bit of the foundations of coaching within their programs as well. So things like have an understanding of psychology, particularly humanistic psychology and positive psychology. A lot of what we do comes from those fields, the humanistic
right.
psychology, with how we hold the client in unconditional positive regard and develop that trusting relationship, and the positive psychology for how we really work with people on their strengths. And I think it's important to know about change management and conflict and so adult learning. All of those things are good. And what we did in the Handbook of Knowledge-Based Coaching was really try and capture the major major theories or practices that influence coaching. It certainly is not all of them, and some would say, I know there's a lot more, and we knew that too, but there was a place where we had to say, we have enough in here now, and we better stop. So,
Right.
Yeah, so that book actually has in it some practical tips for coaches and how do these things relate. And there's a few other resources. I'd say that's what I'm seeing more and more now in coaching books. People actually are starting to pay attention to that. There's another book that I contributed to, The Complete Handbook of Coaching by Elaine Cox and Tatiana Bakrova and David Clutterbuck. So it came out of the UK. They did something similar in taking their some of the theories and then tying them to coaching, just a little different twist in their approach, but also including what's relevant for the practitioner.
Mm-hmm. Very cool, very, very cool. I want to mention to our listeners, if you are listening live and you'd like to call in and ask Diane a question, you can reach us at 424-243-9638. That's 424-243-9638. This would be your opportunity to ask her a direct question and get her perspective on your situation. We invite you to do that. We also invite you to look at her website, CoachDiane.com, and Diane is spelled D-I-A-N-E, CoachDiane.com. So let's keep going here with this whole concept of us being scholars, Diane. I'm fascinated, and I totally support your premise that we have to be scholar practitioners in order to forward the body of knowledge of the profession. I remember one of the very first conferences that we had research as a topic, and the guy from Australia, Anthony, I can't think of his last name, said,
Grant.
Tony Grant.
Yes.
Right. Yes, the professor. He said, we just don't have a big enough body of knowledge yet to even consider ourselves to be a profession. But now with, I think, about 17,000 members of the International Coach Federation globally, if we could all write up our own case studies and write our own articles up, we could exponentially build that body of knowledge.
Yes. Well, and that, in a way, has happened. It's becoming much more. There's certainly many more even master's and doctoral dissertations now that are specifically focused on coaching. And Anthony Grant, I remember I wasn't at the research part of the conference, but I remember I read the proceedings where he was, and in fact I've quoted him on that, where he said, and had conversations with him since then, that he said, within 5 years we'll see a dramatic change, and we have. So I think that was the 2003 conference, and by 2008 there were, he said initially when he looked, I think in 2003 there were maybe like 30 to 60 publications that were relevant to coaching, and now there are thousands.
Right.
And thousands. Yeah, and that's Yeah, so it's pretty amazing. And a lot of them are, excuse me, case studies. Sorry about that. Allergies in Arizona. Never had them in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
But, case studies or small research projects or even we think about, I'd say, one of the things that as I started to get involved with looking at what are we doing and why are we doing it, just simple things like what tools are in place that you can use as a measure for the success of coaching. So in that case I mentioned that with the hospital CEO, one of the things that was absolutely right in front of me that I almost missed was they had an employee satisfaction survey, which is why they called in these consultants in the first place. And we were, because their satisfaction was declining, and we were able to take a look at those results and measure, look at the measurements before the coaching for some of the relevant indicators, and then after the coaching. And I ended up working with senior team as well. But people would say the most dramatic change occurred with the CEO, and because of that, it actually influenced the rest of the organization. But even just looking at measures for success, sometimes we say it's hard, and sometimes it is hard because it's skills that are more people-related skills that change for folks. But at other times, there are if we look a little closer, there are likely some ways we can measure that change that will help us again.
Definitely, because the tone is set at the top. And so if the CEO is doing what they should be doing, in my opinion, then they are, garnering more authenticity and they're building more trust relationships, that all of that's being cascaded down into the organization from the CEO's corner office. And so it would show up in a employee satisfaction survey over year. Yeah, so exciting. So exciting. So let's talk about some of your clients. It seems like you picked really difficult fields to poach in: engineering, science, healthcare, academics, and aerospace. And I have not worked in the aerospace much, or engineering, but I've certainly done a lot of academics and healthcare and science, and I know how difficult those environments are for people to be successful. Mm-hmm. So I'd be fascinated to hear about some more of your success stories. Maybe we heard about the CEO from the hospital, so maybe share one from academia, because that's a tough environment, in my opinion.
It is a tough environment, and I'd say in some of these fields, like healthcare, I have a lot of connections because of my previous background, and so that's that's always been a focus for me to work in healthcare, and I love it. And academia kind of evolved friends or former colleagues that then recommended me to someone, and so that's how I ended up there. And I'd say I agree with you. It is a tough environment, and it is understanding. That's where I think for any of us as coaches working in organizations, it is important to understand the environment. We don't have to be experts in it, but we do have to get a sense of what's happening for that individual or the people that we're working with in that environment. And so I've had the opportunity to work with groups within the academic environment as well as individuals, and I'd say one person stands out where because the system it can be very bureaucratic and hierarchical. It is very frustrating to be able to get anything done, and so it was really about the individual being able to look at, okay, what can I control? What can I do? Mm-hmm. And I'd say the other part, so learning some skills for themselves as well in having those challenging conversations. So one of the tools I really love is the crucial conversations work. And that is a nice framework for people to be able to think through or take themselves through a conversation. Another tool that I use is and how I'm connected to the aerospace industry is the 4D systems work. And I think you had Barbara Walton on a few months ago on Blog Talk. And so I work with Barbara on a NASA contract that we're both on. And so Charlie Pellerin, who's an astrophysicist, who was responsible for the Hubble, developed this this work for 4D systems and has a book, How NASA Builds Teams. And he developed a tool that's fantastic, and it's free for coaches or for anyone. It's called a context shifting worksheet. And basically what he did was take the human equation, you know, that what scientists and engineers and sometimes academics don't want to look at because they really are focused on the data or what's the outcome, and put it in a format that allows that technical mindset to be able to flow through and have that challenging conversation or look at that difficult situation in a way that takes the emotion out of it. So I got a little sidetracked, but back to the academic. So in learning the skills, you know, so there's a department chair, you know, and learning the skills a little more, you know, being able to look at how do I take the emotion out of the situation and examining what is it that's keeping me from saying anything or having the conversation, because some of it was fear, what was going to happen to the job if they did step up and do some things differently. I think that individual was still in their job and capable and learned a lot in realizing that you can say, so I remembered this, I'd say from my early coaching days, people would say you could say anything if you say it from a caring place. Now, I don't always say that in the organization that way, because then, you know, you almost can't use caring, although more and more people do get that, that it's okay to be caring. But, you know, if you say it from a place of respect, of appreciation, and so helping people to see that they can have those difficult conversations instead of just having the conversation, you know, knowing what's in your head but not being able to say it because you're afraid. So I'd say a lot of the work that I've seen or that's been important in academics is helping people to be able to raise the issues that are sometimes, that are often unspoken or felt like to be, not acceptable to raise in a way that they can be heard and at least brought to the surface to be able to be examined and see where they can go from there. So as I'm talking, I guess in a sense, they are learning coaching skills and a bit of a coach approach in that as well.
Yes. And I Googled the context shifting worksheet, and I see it all over the Internet with Charlie Pellerin and some of his slide shares and published books. And,
and if it's something you can post on, if you'd like it, I can always send it to you too and put it on the web, ICF Phoenix website, or if you have a resource section, we can get that to you. He has constantly over the years changed it. I've been working with him since 2008, and he's very innovative and very much an individual who he's always looking at improving the process. And so based on feedback from the users, it changes. And so I think we're really at a pretty good version right now, but I'm sure it will also change as we continue to learn, and he does too. But it's a coaching tool designed by an astrophysicist, so who is not
love
a coach.
It.
But
love it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Love it. Well, we have a very sophisticated technologist on the team, Anna Malikian, our producer of our show. So if you would send us Diane, one of the later versions, and we could definitely get it posted on the ICF Phoenix website, and then our listeners could all download it.
Sure.
That would be fabulous. So thank you so much for mentioning that. I love this story. I love it. Love it. And it proves that, with training, anybody can be a coach, even a you know, a scientist.
Even an astrophysicist, yeah.
That's right.
He wouldn't call himself a coach, but he has certainly, he does have, he knows what needs to happen, and he does, I would say. You know, he's very much a scientist, and he's an amazing individual. But we just love that he designed this in such a way that it really does allow that technical or scientific mindset to get into the people side of the equation. Because if you read the book, How NASA Builds Teams, or you ever have the experience with Charlie, he'll tell you he used to look at people and think, oh, yeah, they're just, you need them to get the job done. Now he, you know, of course, he said people that he worked with really valued him and he valued them, but didn't necessarily show it at the time. And so he looks back and thinks, you know, how much more could have even happened had he realized in the moment, having, you know, being able to appreciate people or have conversations that allow them to more fully express themselves, what value that would have been.
Mm-hmm. Love that he's grown in that awareness,
mm-hmm.
and seeing the power. Very, very cool. Very, very cool. I'll look forward to being able to share that with our listeners. What great experience. So any other successes in your scientific or academic or NASA, for heaven's sake, experience that would be useful to share?
One of my clients just came into mind, and he's another executive, high-level leader in an organization. And what comes to mind actually is something that's it's kind of a little humorous situation, but it's also a bit about the use of metaphor or whatever tool you have in the moment.
Uh-huh.
But this individual was looking at we've been working together for a while, and I hadn't talked with him in a while, but I knew that he was looking at another job, but we hadn't connected, and I got a call on my cell phone. I had been at a client's and I checked my messages and I have this message, Diane, I need to talk to you right away. And this was not an individual that would normally leave that kind of message because, again, you know, very, you know, successful, centered, knows what he wants, doesn't hesitate on decisions. So then I thought, something's wrong. What's happening? So I called him and got him on the phone. And he, early on, we had done the DISC assessment, just as a tool to be able to take a look at what style, you know, to kind of that getting to know yourself a little more to then be able to understand others. And he was very he got so into it that that there was a moment where I said to him, okay, just throw that thing away now. Don't even look at it anymore, because he was too focused on what his style was. So he got over that. And then, but he's in the middle of this decision. When I got him on the phone, I said, I'm in my car. And I said, what's happening? Mike, what's going on? And he said, I have this job offer, you know, and then my place here is offering me something, and he went into a whole story about, and I, you know, I've done all the pros and cons, and I've gone through this, and he had his list, and he was really going, 50 miles an hour in speaking through what was happening and the situation, and I remember listening on the phone and thinking, okay, I have to interrupt him. How am I going to do that? And I looked down at the floor of my car, and there was a quarter on the floor. And I happened to notice that. And so I picked up the quarter, and I said to him, I said, I have a quarter in my hand. I'm going to flip it. And heads, you stay in your job that you're in, or you take the job at your current center. Tails, you move to the new place. He went, what? I said, I repeated it again. He's like, oh, okay. So I flipped the coin. I said, heads, you stay where you're at. He went, I am not staying here. So it just freed him up to actually realize, like, where was his guts about it? What was it that he needed to really examine here? What was really important instead of ruminating about the decision? So it was a real lesson for me in that moment.
I love it. Trusting the process and trusting.
Have.
Right. You had a quarter on the floor of your car.
Now, he has since changed jobs, but, you know, not without, you know, and didn't have that. Actually, we were able to talk about them later. What did that do? And how, not in that moment, but, you know, in a follow-up conversation. But in that moment, it freed him up to be able to do what he needed to do.
Right. Oh, how awesome. I love that. Well, since the Coach Conversations, our Blog Talk Radio show, is sponsored by the Phoenix chapter of the ICF, I think we should talk a little bit about the ICF. I know you have just a long, long history of involvement, but tell us about how you migrated through the Tucson chapter into the international organization and why you stay in the global,
I'll
be interested to know, too, why you stay involved. So,
okay. Well, as I said earlier, I went to my first ICF conference in 2000 in Vancouver, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. These people are people like me interested in this. And you know, 2000, it was a different time, too. We were, you know, still relatively young. You were in it in the early days. But even then, in 2000, there were not everyone there was a coach. And there were all, but there were different people from all over the world. And so I, on my way back to Tucson, I met two coaches on the plane, Joanne Fosland, and Margaret Cridbaum, who I think you know both, you know, and both,
I know both
have been
of
involved
it, yeah.
And long-time ICF long
time,
members.
Yes.
And so I said to them, I want to have this in my community. I want us to have a ICF chapter in Tucson, because we didn't have anything. And they were both very supportive, though very skeptical, because people had tried it before and they weren't sure how many people were really around. And so they said they would be the fairy godmothers of the chapter if I needed any assistance, but, you know, basically said, go for it. And so I said, okay, I will. And I gathered, I started looking at who are the members in the community, or who are the potential members in the community, who are people calling themselves coaches that are here. And that December, actually, we had our first meeting of 12 coaches, and we started our official chapter in January, and I was the first president. And of those 12 coaches, actually, 10 of them are still active as coaches. So it's really fun. And about 8 of them are still here in Tucson.
So it's
really nice. And some have moved to different parts of the country, but still stay in touch. So I was the chapter president, and then and we really developed, you know, we kind of developed ourselves as a chapter. But I was president for 1 year, and then a year later, Margaret Cridbaum called me and said, hey, we need someone to help with, Margaret was on the board of ICF Global, and she asked if I would be interested in participating in the regulatory committee, and so I did that. And actually, in the work on that committee, one of the committee members nominated me for the board, and at first I said, wait, I'm a new coach. I don't think I'm ready for that. And others were saying, oh, yes, you are. You need to do this. So I thought, okay, I guess I can do this. And so I was elected to the board in 2004 and served, or 2003, I guess, was the election. So I served from 2004, and then I was president-elect in 2007, and, vice president 2006, president-elect 2007, and then president 2008, and past president 2009. And so it was a journey. There were moments where in the board I thought, here we are. I'd say we always have this, or at least I had the expectation, others I've talked to tell me they have similar things happen for them, but I had the expectation that we were coaches and this would be easy, but it's not. Because we're all human.
Right.
So we have the same challenges, and I would say to the board, we are just like the organizations we work with, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what we can do here. And it was an amazing experience, though, and I really value the ICF, and I value the chapters. This is where people are generally introduced to coaching. And so the chapters really serve as an important part linking the members to the international organization, to the global ICF.
Yes. So, yes, not everybody can go to the global conferences.
And I stay involved because I really feel, you know, I'm not active on any of the, you know, any of the activities that are happening right now, but I stay involved and periodically check in. Or I'd say one of the things that I like to do is I actually like to read the magazine that comes out from ICF and any of the communications, because it's really fun to see some of the things that we talked about, and I'm sure you see this as well, the things that you talked about when you were a board member are actually starting to happen. Because, again, we're just like organizations.
Yes.
It can't all happen at once. It has to happen over time or as resources become available. So while I was president, the one thing that I was really excited to see that we were able to do, and it wasn't about me, and I'd say when, Barbara Walton and Pam Richard and Steve Mitten, you know, the people that came before me, Kay Cannon, mm-hmm. I think there was really a conscious conscious way of being as president, that the year you were president was not about you, but really about mm-hmm. what's best for the organization. And certainly people before that as well, but it became much more apparent committed to as we were going through. And so one of the things that I really was excited about, because I realized when I was in Europe one time for ICF how challenging it was for someone in another country to actually be connected to the international organization because the office wasn't open if you needed something or there wasn't anyone to answer your message.
Right.
And so we really worked hard at looking at how do we create a truly international organization. And so we opened the first regional service centers in Europe and then Australia in 2008, and that was really exciting. And now to see that they've actually opened several others, and that the U.S. has their own, you know, or North America, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, so that actually there are people available in your own time zones, or at least you know, in reasonable hours within your time zones.
That is
now
awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge, 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 because people just don't feel welcome if they can't get their
mm-hmm.
questions answered and they can't take care of their business.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes.
So on behalf of all of our listeners, Diane, I want to thank you for your years of service, and I should say decades of service, and your commitment to helping us move ourselves forward as a profession. I'm so personally grateful, and I know all of our listeners are so grateful, too, for your wisdom and expertise. Again, people can find out more about you at www.coachdiane.com. They can go to our Blog Talk Radio Show website at blogtalkradio.com/ICF Phoenix. You can find us on Facebook. So lots of ways for our listeners to plug in. There's a couple of shows coming up that I'd like to share, and then I want to circle back, Diane, and see if there's anything that you have to say in closing. So next month, on May 9th, 2004, Phoenix time, which is Pacific Daylight Time, 2 p.m., we're going to have our own very own producer, Anna Malikian, Ph.D., BCC, ACC. So please join us for that. Anna is elite-level certified coach with Michael Port, Book Yourself Solid, and is a genius at not just the technology but in the marketing and positioning and branding, and everybody will gain great value from our interview with Anna. And then on June 13th, we're going to have Christopher McAuliffe, MCC. That will also be at 2 p.m. Phoenix time. So we look forward to having you all join us then. So, Diane, anything in closing that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I'd say stay involved, get involved with your chapter or with the international organization. There is a place wherever your interest is, and really think about being that contributor in whatever way serves you, because really it's those of us in practice doing the coaching and working with others. We have a lot to contribute. So it's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Oh, it's just a delight, Diane, an absolute delight. And we look forward to getting that resource, the Context Shifting Workshop sheet, and posting that for our listeners. And we look forward to staying connected with you and seeing you at an ICF event. So thank you so much for being with us today, Diane.
You're welcome.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks.